This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You are listening to iFanboys Talksplode with Rainbow Rowell. Hey, this is Josh Flanagan. It's another episode of iFanboy Talksplode. This is our creator interview show. I've enunciated every word of that perfectly. Today I am talking with writer and author Rainbow Rowell, a well-known YA author. Then she popped into comics and just had it from the start with her Runaways run. Now she's on She-Hulk. We spent a good long time talking about creating comics and writing and all sorts of stuff. I am a big fan. And I'm guessing you will be too. Hey, this is Josh Flanagan with iFanboy.com, and I'm here with Rainbow Rowell, author and comic book writer, which I guess are sort of the same thing. But hi.
Hi.
I will start with this thing. I checked. I was like, well, is her real name Rainbow? Because I pictured myself saying hi, Rainbow, and I thought that feels a little unusual.
It feels weird.
It is your real name.
Yeah, it's my real name. It's my given name from my mom. But it feels weird for me to say even, and I don't mind you asking.
Really?
Because it still feels like a noun. I appreciate it because I feel like it's the name really starts out as a liability with people. Like, I don't feel like I win friends and influence people by saying my name is Rainbow. It helps me to be like, you know, my mom gave me this name, but then I don't think it stays a liability normally, because I think I've had jobs. I used to be a newspaper reporter, and so I've always had jobs where it's kind of helped me if people remembered my name. Mm-hmm. So people don't always remember that it's Rainbow, but they remember it's Goofy. So they remember it's unusual. And so I used to really hate it, but I'm kind of like at peace with it now. And I feel like it's – but anytime I enter sort of a new space, and comics is a new space, I think, mm-hmm. Oh, people must think I was just like, you know what my pen name is going to be? It's going to be Rainbow Rowell, you know?
Did you ever go through a period where you pretended that, or like, you know, chose a different name to use?
No. My mom was very much like, you can change your name when you're 18, because I didn't love it. And then by the time you're 18, asking everyone to call you something else is
– sure.
tricky. And yeah. I was a newspaper reporter, and that's a job where you want to have a transparency and honesty and authenticity. You don't want to choose a pen name for that. And then I'd been a newspaper writer for so long, by the time I was an author, the idea of choosing a pen name, that felt like, well, I'm Rainbow Rowell now, and then now I'm not, like, mm-hmm. that felt strange. But I do think, I mean, I still think I feel like it probably discourages people from picking up my books, because it's not even
really?
Like a little. Yeah, I do think so. Huh. Yeah, I do. Because I think it's like people assume I chose it, and then they start imagining what sort of person would choose it. Like, what sort of adult, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We're probably talking about this way. Too long, Josh. Should we just do it?
I'm good. It's funny because my website is called ifanboy.com, and yeah. I hate it. But
why?
It's antiquated. It's gendered in a way that, like, I think makes us seem immature. But I came up with it with my friends when we started the comic book website in 2000, and
yeah,
I was
totally
22.
Different context.
You know, and then we were started doing the podcast. And we got known by it. And now it's just iFanboy. And if I don't think about what it is, I'm fine with it. But, you know, I'm 45 and I don't want to be called that.
I have to admit, I didn't think any... Well, this isn't an admission. I didn't think anything bad.
Well, I mean, there's a billion, comic book podcasts, you know, that have dorky names.
Yeah.
But it's, you know...
It sounds enthusiastic to me. It does sound enthusiastic.
That is what it was. Like, at the time, it was like, there was the iMac, and it was like...
Oh, right. Okay, yeah. I had to go back into my brain back to 2000.
Yeah, the
right.
Whole deal. So, let's...
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So we both have our anxiety. I chose mine. You got yours, but we had a deal.
I got mine from my mom, so...
Yeah. Well, join the club. And then you become a writer. It all makes sense.
Right.
So there are probably lots of things out there about your book writing and things like that. And I'm sure we will touch on and go into it. But I'm not an expert on those things. And I'm guessing there's a lot of information out there. So I'm going to steer this towards comics because it's the thing I know and it's the thing people are listening for.
Sure.
So I've read the Wikipedia. You wrote your first book while you were working another job.
Yep.
It did well. People notice you've written a bunch of books since then.
Yes.
I saw...
That's exactly what my Wikipedia page says.
I am summarizing. I've had a day.
It's like, I know, she wrote some books.
Listen,
I will not be qualified
on it.
Yeah.
At some point, looked like you signed to do a graphic novel with First Second. And so how did you get to the point where you go from doing prose to working on making comic books? Was it an offer? Was it a thing that you, like, what was your relationship with comics prior to that?
I think I actually, it might not have come into print first, but I think I actually started Runaways before Pumpkinhead's, my first graphic novel.
Really?
My relationship to comic books was... my dad read a ton of comics, and that should have been probably the way that I started with comics. And in a way it was, because he would buy me, like Richie Rich comics. And I liked those a lot, but my dad was a Marvel reader, and he, I don't think he thought that comics were for girls. Like, I think he thought there were boy comics and girl comics. So he really steered me away from his superhero comics and toward more, like funny comics.
And we're talking about, I think you're a little bit older than me, so late 70s, early 80s?
Yeah.
And so, like, back then, there's not a ton of all-ages comics outside of, you know, Richie Rich and maybe an Archie here and there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in some ways there were a ton, and in other ways there weren't, right? But there were, Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck comics,
right.
All of the Richie Rich comics, right? So, And I think maybe Marvel Comics and DC Comics were a little bit more all ages then. But he definitely was like buying me funny comics and buying like superhero comics for himself and for my brother.
Yeah.
But then I got into junior high and I fell in with a group of boys who were reading comics, superhero comics. I really just... started borrowing their comics and really fell in love with them. And so by the time I was in high school, and I got a job in college, I was just spending all of my money on comics. So
you're like a weekly reader. You were going to the shop and it was Tuesdays.
Yeah, at that time I was broke. So I was a quarter box hound. I was just living off of whatever I could get cheap. And I really early on became an X person. So I mostly read mutant comics. Mm-hmm.
Would you just read them like randomly as you found them, or are you trying to build like a run? Because the X-Men comics are difficult if you're not in order. I look back on comics from the 80s with this, like, when you're a kid, you could pick up a comic, you could read it, and that'd be all. You'd find your context, you'd do the thing, and then maybe you'd find another one that had something to do with it, but they don't do that anymore, so it's a little easier, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think... One thing is, in the 80s, you had no expectation that the world was going to give you a Wikipedia page for everything. Mm-hmm. So you experienced being lost a lot of time. You know, like, you experienced the world with a lot less context in 1989, which is probably when I started reading X-Men comics. So I, you know, I knew that I was reading something that it was already in the hundreds of issues. I think that's right. And, you know, so I knew I was deep, deep down the stream, midstream. And then I wasn't getting them in any order from my friends. You know, they would just be like, oh, you want to read X comics? Well, you know, and they were buying whatever they had. They weren't buying full runs. Mm-hmm. You know, my friends would be like, they would basically go to the shop and buy whatever covers they liked, you know? So they'd be like, here are two Transformers comics and one X-Force comic. And, you know, like, and I was reading it completely out of order. I'm very methodical. I'm kind of a Hermione. So I, in college, carried with me a little tiny notebook that had like, you know, two pages for all of the mutant books. And then I would keep track of what I had, and I would go through the quarter boxes trying to build them up. So the way that worked for me is I ended up reading the sort of comics nobody wanted to read first, because that's what I could get cheap. So like so I'd read like, you know, Alpha Flight, you know, like the full run of Alpha Flight. And then the mutant books here and there, because at that point there weren't really collections.
Right.
You know, so
you had to work back then. Like
you really had to work, and you always had an incomplete knowledge, and you were really depending on oral tradition a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. So you'd read a comic and you'd say to your friend, like, I don't understand what's happening with Madeline Pryor. And they'd be like, yeah, okay, do you have an hour? And then they would try to tell you everything they knew, which would be a very imperfect understanding of it. And then someone else would be adding to it. Yeah, it was way more just like people just talking and sharing what they knew, you know, whereas now I would mm-hmm. never ask a person a question that. And if I did, they'd say, why don't you Google that? That's kind of how I got through college. And then when I got a real job, I really settled into, I was the person who would have my pull list was just like every X-Men comic, anything that a mutant showed up in, I bought for about 10 years.
Oh, wow. And did you finally fall off at a certain point?
I'm more like went into rehab, basically. I like just was at a point where I was buying so many books a month, and I was feeling kind of addicted. Like I would feel like I have to read every mutant book to understand what's going on in every other mutant book. And I mean, that nobody was telling me I had to do that. I just felt that I had to. And I was like, I'm not enjoying this as much. I'm just feeling kind of like breathless about having to have coverage. And so then I had a baby and my pull list built up, and I was like, you know what? That's it. I'm like detoxing.
Wow. I respect that.
You do?
No, I totally do.
Even now, I feel kind of wary of the X-Men. I'll be like, I don't read them. And I feel like if I pick it up, it's just like, oh man, I'm going, you know, falling off the wagon. I'm going to like be reading 10 books a month again. This isn't a very good thing for me to say as a Marvel employee, I guess.
I get it. I've been doing, you know, I did a pick of the week. You know, we would basically do a review every week of my life since 2000. We started doing our podcast in 2005. So every, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, we read a bunch of books so we can do a show on Friday and put it out on Sunday. And it was my full-time job for a little while. But there's a thing like, what would I do if we stopped doing this? Like, I like comics. I like them in a different way than I used to. And I still enjoy reading comics. But there is an incredible momentum to it that if one day it wasn't there, I'd just be interested to see what that feels like.
I wasn't reading anything else. And so part of it was like, I was like, I haven't read a book. This isn't now. This is at that point. I was like, I haven't read a book for years. Perhaps I should. But I was really worried. I always had the stack by my bed of, I mean, I'm just like all mutants all the time. And I was like, oh no, I've got to read all this. And so what I did is and I don't know what you would do if you stopped doing your show. I hope you don't stop doing your show until you want to. But yeah. Well, I started, instead of following characters, I started following creators more. And that's actually when I got into Runaways, because I just loved Brian K. Vaughan and his writing. And I thought, okay, I'm going to read everything, you know, I can from this guy. And I'm going to start paying better attention to which comics am I enjoying the most. And instead of following like characters from book to book, I'm going to start following writers and artists from book to book. And that changed my comics reading a lot.
Now, I'll go back a slight. Now, if Wikipedia again is to be believed, you started writing your first book around this time. So you said what I'm getting to is that you said you hadn't read a book in a really long time, but you did start writing one.
I did start writing one. Yeah, I was writing my book.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I was also feeling like I didn't want to be influenced by other books, and that if I was reading comics, I'm always afraid I'm too much of a mimic. That
right.
I kind of
like, understand.
Yeah. Like if you're talking to me in an accent, I'll start talking back to you in that accent. It's embarrassing and dumb. So, yeah. So at that time I was just reading comics and I started writing the book, but then I felt kind of like, okay, well this book won't, it is so different from what I'm reading. And it's not like I'd never read a book. I used at, before I had been kind of a, you know, a huge reader of everything. Yeah.
And then
yeah, I started writing my first book, Attachments. And then my second book, Eleanor and Park, is about two kids who fall in love reading comics together. They fall in love with each other over X-Men comics and Watchmen. And so that's what led to me working in comics, because Nick Lowe at Marvel read Eleanor and Park and was like, you seem like you actually love comics. And I was like, yes, no, I do. And he was like, why don't you write a comic for us? So that's how that happened.
He's the best guy.
He's great. He's a wonderful guy.
Yeah.
He's a great editor too, actually.
No, he absolutely is. Yeah. And he's got like, some people know talent really well, and like he just can sort of suss it out, and you can see all these people that he sort of brought in.
He likes to take risks, and I think he's also he merely makes you feel like he is going to support you as you try this new thing. With me, he was very much like, you know, I'll be there. Don't worry too much about not understanding this format, because I'm going to be right there with you.
So did you get an email from him? Did you meet him at a thing when did it start?
I don't meet people at things usually. I usually go to things.
There's a book show or something.
Yeah, no, I actually met him the first time through email. He sent me an email. It seemed kind of fake to me. It seemed so like, oh, this is happening in this fake space inside my computer that I actually asked for Runaways right away, because he was, I think he wanted me to write a Spider-Gwen thing. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, you know, this is what I'd really like to do. And he was like, let's talk about that. So that it started moving right away. And then I didn't actually have time to start. And then they didn't get the book approved for a while. So it was like, we were kind of both waiting for each other for a long time. But yeah, he right away we were talking about Runaways.
So when you said, I want to write Runaways right away, did you have like a concept of what you wanted to do?
I more had the concept of that is my favorite Marvel book. That like, I have, you know, probably my favorite character, my favorite, like, I love the mutants. I have other characters I really love. But if there was just one book that I loved the most, it was Runaways. And Runaways, honestly, it's the sort of thing I write. It's the sort of writing I like anyway. Writing about young people, writing about a big group of people, writing about, you know, all these people who are kind of, you know, have friendships and romantic relationships. That's sort of, I'm drawn to that. I write that. So I think I knew I could do that. Mm-hmm. And also I felt like there just was so much potential to bring those characters back, and they have, I just wanted them back. And I wanted Gert back. I really, really wanted Gert back. I think.
My favorite character, I was like, I think she means Gert. And I was about to ask, but I think that was clear from the writing. Not in a bad way, in a good way.
My Runaway's favorite character is my favorite. Oh, no, it's not Gert, actually. No. And Chris Lanka used to like mercilessly out me for this. Like, because I would always be like, don't tell people what our favorite characters are, because then they'll notice the favoritism. And then he would at every opportunity tell people that I was favoring Victor. I'm like, shut up.
Interesting choice.
But Gert, I think, is the best character. I think she's just a phenomenal character. And I just felt like you could bring her back. I mean, and I don't know if that's what the original creators would have wanted, but I just thought she's a great character. And the whole team, you know, every time I'd gone back to that book, I had been like, I just think that the original run of Runaways doesn't really get old. And it's, I just loved everything about them. I loved Leapfrog. I loved their the mansion they lived in. I loved it all.
It's funny because I don't think I've read it since it was coming out in issues. And I loved it. I mean, at the time, Brian Vaughn was the guy who could do no wrong. He's the master of the single issue. And then, you know, a bunch of other people tried. And there were good runs. But I think that I'm not shining your shoes right here. A little bit like your run on it was the first time that I was like, okay, I feel like we're back in this world. Like in a permanent way, which didn't hurt because it was a really, you know, substantial run. So you get a chance to do this thing that is not in a medium that you've done, and you know, story is story and characters are characters, but the mechanics of comic books are difficult, and you're going to start doing this at kind of the highest level.
Like, yeah.
Did you know where to start?
I knew where I wanted the story. Yeah, I knew where to go with it. Yeah, I knew where I wanted the story to go. Mm-hmm. I was most intimidated by just the act of, like, how many panels to put on a page.
Right. And that's kind of what I meant in terms mm-hmm. of start, like, how to actually make the thing.
Yeah. I read a book about writing comics. I read the Bendis book about writing comics. Right. And the thing that's nice about that book is that it's not just how he does it. He has all of these different writers talk about what they do. And what that did for me was make me think, oh, okay, yeah, no, there's just not one way to do this. Mm-hmm. But you can see the practical things that you need. You know, like, the difference when you're writing a novel is you're telling a story to the reader, but mm-hmm. when you're writing a comic, you're telling a story to the artist. Like, your audience for that script is the artist. You know, the artists, really, the other people who are coming along on the book. And so it's a totally different information flow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's the big shift is instead of talking to the reader, thinking about how you're talking to the artist and the colorist and the letterer and what those three people need to know from you. That was the biggest shift. And then the episodic nature of it is very different. I think with that, I just had the muscle memory of having read a million comic books to mm-hmm. know the rhythms of it.
I mean, that's a modest way to segue. It still takes, you know, that takes a lot. And especially coming from, you know, it is my experience that when a lot of novelists come in to make comics, they're not. I was very confused when you first started doing Runaways because, you know, I was like, well, who's this person? Oh, she's a novelist. Yeah. But it didn't read, it read like a comic book, and there wasn't too many words.
Thank you.
And there wasn't, and I mean, it makes sense that you'd been reading comics forever because, you know, that's a very normal thing for people who've come into comics to do, is just sort of overdo it. Did you feel like you had it, or was there editorial, you know, like, hey, how about doing five panels here instead of nine or something like that? You can just say I did it because I'm awesome.
I mostly had that part of it. I think actually Nicola would like me to write more. Like, there are times when Nick is like, you know, you've got chops. You can do more. He'll say, you can do a couple guitar solos, you know, like, it's mm-hmm. okay to just get in there and write it. I think I like to be spare. So I think that helped me as a novelist. I was a journalist for 10 years.
Right.
And so as a novelist, I tend to be sort of spare and plain spoken. Which helps, I think, because it means that I don't mm-hmm. miss giving up the narration. I think that as a novelist, you can overuse the narration. Mm-hmm. But all that said, I'm sure there are people who think there's too much, you know, I'm sure there are people who think there's too much talking in my books. There's always a lot of talking. So, you know, maybe there are people who think I'm not making that transition very well. You know, maybe for mm-hmm. some people, they're like, oh, this is obviously a novelist. But for me, I felt
it
like,
isn't.
Well, oh, well, thanks. Okay. I mean, okay. Well, yeah, you and I think I'm doing an okay job, and I appreciate it.
Yeah.
but yeah, I feel like I had you read so many comics.
Yeah.
I knew what a comic mostly looked like. And even as I say that, there's a lot of variation. I was just looking at a Neil Gaiman comic and thinking, like, just the spectrum of narration and how many words you can put on a page and still be writing an excellent comic.
I mean, it really comes down to, I mean, the skill of the writer yeah. and artist, in that, you know, there are pages, I talk about this a lot, and you know, there are books that are okay, and then you turn your page and you get a wall of text, and
yeah.
it's two people standing in a room and the word balloons are all over the place, and I just think that poor letterer, and it can yeah. stop you cold. But then
yeah.
there are people who can do it. You know, like Bendis. You don't notice that if you're reading a Bendis book.
No, I like his books, yeah.
You just flow through that wonderful dialogue and you know, it's fine. So,
and
you know,
I really like Neil Gaiman books. Like, those are some of my...
Yeah.
I don't mind doing the reading if the writing is really good. And if yeah. it's sort of pulling you along, but...
Did you ever read Strangers in Paradise?
That's interesting. It's fascinating that you say that because Nick just suggested it to me, and I just ordered it just 2 days ago. We were talking about it because we were talking about this very issue. We were talking about words on the page. And Nick was like, my memory of Strangers in Paradise is that there were a lot of words on the page, but that I loved it. Is this your memory as well?
It's not that so much as that he would stick in like a page of text. It would be like a page of prose in the middle of it. And when you're in the process of, you know, plowing through a comic book, it's got a pace.
Yeah.
And if you're slowed on that, it should be sort of devastating to the onward movement. But it wasn't, because he could do it.
And
like there would be one instinct to go, maybe I can skip this. But then I'd start to read it and I wouldn't even notice. We'd go right by. And that's sort of a masterful kind of thing.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind because I'm going to read that. I feel like I'm someone like in Alan Moore books who always did skip the pages of, like, I'm embarrassed to say that, but it's true. I would be like,
the pirate story?
Yeah, I skipped the pirate story until like the third time around.
My partner in the show who does this to me, one of my longest friends, he's never read the pirate part. He just refuses.
It adds something.
No, I mean, it does. And by the third time, you kind of like, well, what does this say? Because that book gives and gives and gives as you keep rereading it. But yeah. No, you're not alone.
The hard thing for me and the thing that I don't, I told myself I wasn't actually going to talk. I was like, don't talk about your weaknesses. It just draws attention to them. But the thing that I have the hardest time with and I still struggle with is how much space to give fight scenes. When I go back to the first run of Runaways, I look at the fight scene, I just cringe every time. Chris Anka, the artist, did a wonderful job, but like I just didn't give him that much space because I didn't want to give up space for plot because you just don't have much space in 6 issues with that many characters and everybody's got their own story. And
is that what you had to begin with, 6?
I think 6, yeah. I think the first arc was 6. Over time, we did, I think, 1 5-issue arc and 1 8-issue arc. But I'm pretty sure we started with 6. The thing I always want is, especially with Runaways, you know, those characters were like a mess at the beginning. They're in 1,000 different places. They've been, you know, characters get passed around. And they get passed around and everybody leaves their, you know, dents and fingerprints on them. And then when you pick them up, you're like, okay, what do I need you to get this character in functioning order for this story. So you're doing that at the beginning and you're kind of, you know, setting them up and building a foundation and reminding people what their relationships are. And in all of that, in 6 issues, it's like, well, and not, pardon me. Okay. So you're doing that. And then in 6 issues, and then you get to the point where you're like, okay, well, okay. And we've got the climax of this plot. So I just look back at that first run and think I should have given the fight so much more space. And so now I do, and now I'm like, am I giving too much space? This is the thing I think about that I think I do not have down all the time is how much space to leave for action.
How did you end up, you know, scripting stuff? Like what did you sort of decide on would be your method?
At first I would kind of like describe. I would like basically write a description for each panel, and then I would be like, but if you want. Do whatever you want. If this isn't what you want, if you want to tell this a different way, you can mix it up. With Chris and I talked so much, and we kicked it off together. We did a lot of planning. We did a lot of character development before I even started drawing the book. So there was so much back and forth that my scripts with Chris were like kind of bulleted lists of these are the 6 things that need to happen on this page. Mm-hmm. Then after the first arc, I got a little bit more like, panel 1, this, panel 2, this, panel 3, this, because I wouldn't necessarily be working with Chris. Other artists were coming in. And I felt like I needed to have a little bit more structure. Not that there wasn't structure before, but I just got a little bit more like specific, like this has to happen in this panel. And even now I don't really care if an artist is like, that didn't work, I'm gonna do something different, it's okay. But yeah, at first it was much more me saying, here are the things that need to happen on this page. And it got a little bit
full dialogue in there. I mean, it wasn't Marvel style, I assume.
Oh yeah, yeah, you're kind of in between Marvel style and what's the other style called?
Fully scripted, I guess.
It's fully scripted. 2 ends. I write them actually. What I write them like is, and I even use them. I use a screenplay format, so I write them like a screenplay.
Yeah.
I don't know what.
I did that too.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't know what to call that, but yeah. So it's definitely not full Marvel style where it's just like, hey, here's the thing that happens. I mean, I'm writing all the dialogue and I'm writing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you generally in your storytelling, do you tend to plan things, you know, in terms of plotting?
Oh yeah. You know, I write the whole arc all at once.
Okay.
I outline and then I write all six issues, boom, 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 like all together. And I write it all at once.
You're working with Chris Anka, who's a great artist, you know, one of those sort of artist, you know, like not necessarily a huge name, but like anybody who sort of knows the art form is like, oh, that dude's good. Like, did you understand the sort of the nuances of comic book storytelling in a way that, like, and I say this because it took me years to sort of understand, like, the little things about comics that I really like and appreciate now when you talk about somebody who's really good at it, which most people don't or shouldn't need to notice because, you know, that's the point. Like, you're not supposed to notice. You're just supposed to go through it. You know, but, like, do you feel like this helped you get an understanding of that stuff, or did you sort of think about comics that way beforehand? Does that make sense?
It makes like the foundational sense. I'm not quite sure. Zach, can you give me kind of an example of what you mean?
Like, at what point did it sort of click with you as you were writing, you know, as you're trying to write comic books, like how comic book storytelling really works, like in a way that you are, you know, actively using and thinking about, as opposed to when you're just writing, you know, reading it, you kind of notice it works, but not really. But, you know, you are the one who's sort of there and you've got to, you know, analyze it at a different level than you used to just as a reader.
Right.
Or do you think of it that way?
I think that it's a little different for me because I've been only a writer.
Right.
That's my only job. And so I think that I tend to break things down as I'm not really fun to watch television with because I am.
Same problem.
Yeah. If you start thinking critically about stories all the time, you can't help but take stories apart as you're experiencing them. And so I think I was already sort of maybe a little bit more analytical, but I also think it's like, I think it's a lot like just sort of, I want to say like singing, or, you know, you're just, you kind of know the rhythm of it. For me, it's a lot about knowing the rhythm and then making sure my work sort of sings along with that rhythm. So listening to, like, okay, it feels like something else should be happening now. It feels like we should be shifting scenes now. It feels like we should be ending the... And once you get into, like, the rhythm of an issue, it's like an internal clock. But I'm not... I wrote the first arc by myself because we didn't have an artist yet. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't writing to anyone's strengths at that point. I was just writing,
that's actually probably a really good manifestation of the thing that I'm doing. That I'm asking
about. Like being conscious of. I did that. And then Chris came on board. And Chris also had loved The Runaways. So he was invested in these characters. And then Chris and I were able to talk so much about the characters and where they were going. And then it didn't change the first arc tremendously because that was in the can. Mm-hmm. But it changed the next arcs because one of the things is, Chris loves clothes and is a genius and could probably be a designer, like a clothing designer. He's wonderful. And so what they were wearing became more important and became much more, a part of the plot. Even like, Chase's outfits are jokes. And then Gert all through the first run only wears, because when she comes back, you know, she'd been dead and she comes back from the past, basically. She doesn't have any of her clothes. So all of her clothes that she wears in that first couple of runs are clothes that Chase wore in Brian K. Vaughan's run, in Adrian Alfona's. So that sort of thing is the thing, if you have a really, you know, Chris and I, my relationship, I was like, hey, what do you think of this? Oh yeah, that's a great idea. So, you know, we'd go pouring through the old comics, trying to look at what clothes Gert could adapt to be wearing. And so she's always wearing Chase's old clothes, which is also sort of angsty and romantic because
they were in love with each other. That is a quality Easter egg. That's
a good one.
I'm impressed by that.
And
one of those, there's a lot of great comic book artists who can't draw clothes like actual people wear, or at least from the era that people were living in. And you know, now that you mention it, I think it was a thing, and I didn't realize what you were saying specifically about that they came from, but you know, they looked like kids. They looked like clothes that kids would wear, you know, and
almost
that,
no one draws clothes like Krasanka. I mean, he just.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's a big deal. Like, there are comics, you know, there are guys who, and they're guys, you know, drew books in the 80s. And when they draw comics now, they've still got all the same chops they ever did. But everybody kind of looks like they're from the 80s and it don't work.
Yeah.
But it did, you know, it's interesting. I'm going to totally watch for that now when I see Chris's work. He's one of those guys that, like, if I see his name on a book, I'll read that book.
But and I was like, let's get them into situations where, like, let's send them to a ball so that they can wear ball gowns. Let's do, you know, let's come up with something. And but the Runaways, they don't have costumes or uniforms, so they get to wear different clothes. He's designing new clothes for 5 or 6 kids, and even Doombot got new clothes every month. He's designing all new clothes for them.
So you've got these 6 issues to start with. You do that arc. It's in the can.
Yeah, yeah.
But that, you know, it's a whole big story. Like, when did you sort of have the whole thing where you had sort of beginning, middle, and end? Was that in place from the beginning, or did you have to build that out later?
I had like 4 or 5 goals. So I like knew, should I spoil things? Is it, or no?
Yeah, no, I think it's been long enough. It's fine.
Yeah. So I knew that I wanted, I knew that I wanted Victor to get his, I wanted Victor to come back. I wanted it to be a slow thing for him to get his body back.
Right.
I knew I wanted to bring Alex back, but I didn't want to bring her back right away. I knew that when I brought Alex back, I wanted to make Alex's villainy a little bit more complicated. And I wanted to make him a little bit more someone whose path we understood. I knew I wanted Molly to be kind of in the cusp of adolescence and start to have some adolescent feelings. I knew I wanted Molly to not be cute and happy for an arc. Mm-hmm. I wanted to keep Chase and Gert apart, but I knew that I wanted to bring future Gert back in an age appropriate way if I could get there. So it was kind of like I had like a half a dozen long-term goals, but most of them were things that we needed to work toward because you couldn't do them in the first arc. They wouldn't be that meaningful.
Right.
So it was like, okay, I've got these 6. And then I've got the first arc. I know it's going to happen in the first arc. In the first arc, we're getting them back together. We're strengthening their ties. We're showing what's changed and why that's hard for each of them. Like, when they come back together after being apart for so long, it's not easy. And then, so I had like my first arc goals. And then usually when I was writing the first arc, I'd come up with whatever the next arc would be. And it kind of, often it would come out of where the characters were, like, what would be an interesting way to challenge these characters, and what could happen now? What could come out of this? And so usually by the time I got to 6, I would have the next arc planned, but it wouldn't be, you know, we'd get approved in 6-issue increments. Mm-hmm. So I'd have to wait and see, are we going to get more issues? And then I'd write those 6 issues. And then by the time I got to the end, I'd be like, oh, I know where we're going now. And it kind of felt like with every arc, we were hitting our goals. At one point, Nick did say, like, I wanted Victor and Gert to get together, and I wanted Carolina and Nico to get together. And Nick was like, let's just do it all now, just in case. You're like, we might not get there. So that all happened in one arc in one issue. You know, it's like, okay, we're doing all the kissing in one issue, and just in case we don't get 6 more issues. Mm-hmm. But every time we'd hit one of those goals, I would feel so good, like, oh man, we got to the. I never thought this book would live long enough that we would hit that goal, but we did. We just got to that goal.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a charmed first ongoing comics experience for you.
Yeah,
you
got really to
get
great.
All the way through. How many issues was the whole thing?
38.
30s? Yeah.
38.
That's amazing.
We got to the run. At the end, I think we only got a couple more issues because they wanted to get us to the Runaways 100. Mm-hmm. So we got to 100. Yeah.
They want to have their cake and eat it too with the numbers. Yeah.
It was like, we got there. It's over.
Yeah. So, you know, let me, if you were writing your Runaways story all the way through, if you were writing it in terms of a prose book, would that be like one book, or would that be a series of books? Like, how would you think of it? I find myself
it's
thinking
not
that
really
way.
Apples and apples.
Yeah?
No, it's not really the same because, you know, a comic has to have one. Each issue has to have like feel like a complete story in a way. Like it has to be like one arc, and so it's a much more like you know, like in a novel is the song that can like you know, be like an overture that like builds and builds and builds and builds and then gets louder and more complicated and then, you know, crescendos 8 minutes in. Whereas a comic is more like a song you hear on the radio where it needs to kind of, if you think of the, and then it has a larger crescendo for those six issues, but it definitely the rhythm of those six issues, you know, is like, we're getting bigger. And then, you know, you're like, you're always like little hills as you climb the mountain. Yeah. So it's not the same. And I can't like plot them the same.
That makes sense. I think that I get it in your mind that you come from being a novelist and I love long form storytelling. Like, I love it in comics. I like, you know, like the way that The Wire is structured, you know, or the way that, you know, like, I like a big story. I don't necessarily like episodic stuff. And earlier I said Brian K. Vaughan is the master of the single issue, and he still is, and he's sort of able to do that both ways. But you're in the 20s or so, I think, oh, cool. Like, this is one big story. I just assume, like, this is actually going to end, too. Like, have an ending, because that doesn't, you know, comics are the illusion of change as you sort of stumble forward. But, it's good. You should have been thinking about it in issue and arc forms for sure.
Well, here's the deal. I think I wanted it to feel, you know, we could get canceled any minute, but I wanted to have goals. Like, if we get that far here, you know, here's a series of goals and maybe we'll get them. But I like to plan because I like the feeling of something coming together. Like the feeling that like, oh, I didn't even realize this was building over the last 2 years. And now here we are and it's all coming together. I think that's like, as a reader, I think that's very satisfying when a slow burn finally boils over. So I definitely wanted to have that planned out. Should we get there? Let's be ambitious. Let's say, you know, we're going to get there, or let's try to get there and let's lay the foundation. You know, the unfortunate thing is then some things feel unfinished if you get canceled. But yeah, I like planning because the something I hated as a reader is when it just felt like one red herring after another, like dead ends, you know, that never got picked up. I really hated it when something had been building and building with a character and then the creative team would change and that would get dropped.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I don't know. Is that kind of what we were talking about, this idea, like long form versus short form?
Yes.
It's like both at once, right? Comics is both at once.
It is. I mean, it's like soap operas. It's the illusion moving forward, like, but no one really does. Batman doesn't get older. You know, if anybody had been through that much trauma, he would not be functional. I don't care how tough he is.
But don't you think that as a reader, you actually need there to be some change? Like, even if he learns the same lessons over and over and over, like, he's going that.
I think it's the perception of change, and that's what good, like, ongoing comic writers do. You know, when we're talking about
Vertigo.
I feel
like there has to be some change.
Yeah? Well, I mean, the other thing is, they change over the years, you know, just by different people coming in, different times, whatever. Like, it slowly morphs. Like, there's different versions. Batman's the easiest one because he's been around for 80 years. You know, there's different versions of them throughout. And the characters, at its core, for whatever reason, so strong that it can sort of absorb and change with all those things. But I don't know.
I feel like there has to be change in the arc you're reading or in the story you're reading. There has to be real change. But it might not stick. It might not be lasting.
Yeah.
And it's always interesting the changes that do become lasting.
And I think that's what I mean. Like, I think you can do that within your story or your issue or whatever. But if you back way up and you look at the whole arc of stories, like, you kind of have to let some of it go, which is, you know, the concept behind the No Prize or whatever.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So when you went to did you go to school to be a journalist?
Yeah, I did.
Like, was that your,
I studied journalism. I did three things. I did journalism, advertising, and fiction writing, and then I've done all of those now.
So, nice work. Because a lot of people, you know, they want to be a writer, and they're not sure what to do, and they go into journalism. Like, was your first thing is like, I want to be a journalist, I want to work in a newspaper or do whatever?
Saw that as a way to have health. This is betrays my age.
I
saw it as a way to have health insurance and be a writer. You know, I was like, I want to be a writer. But I don't. I want to have a steady, stable job. And at that point, it was a stable job. I was a columnist. I know it's not anymore, right? Now it's like, Thunderdome. But at the time, it was a stable job.
How did you become a columnist? It feels like it should take a while to get to that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I wanted to do it. I tried. I tried to do a good job. I got there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, I think that my brain is a storytelling brain. And so that served me well as a newspaper reporter. It's how I became a columnist, and you know, it's what I did. And I, you know, a column is like writing the same thing three times a week, the same length. It's a little bit like comics, right, where you write exactly the same length every time.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's a little bit. It's repetitive in kind of a bad way, actually, because you get to be like a machine that makes the same thing.
Yeah. When we used to, our website used to be like content every day and things like that. So I got into that rhythm for sure.
It's really similar, actually, frankly, to do. Yeah. You're doing the same thing. You know, like, you know how it feels. It gets a little bit like a rhythm that you know too well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, as a columnist, yeah.
Do you still think of things in terms of columns? Like, you see something going on and you're like, paragraph one. Okay, yeah, I got that. Okay,
you know what I think about with columns, the worst part about writing a column, I think, in anybody who does a podcast or a blog feels this, is just the pressure to have something to say. And then sometimes you say things that you regret because you were just trying to produce content, you know? And like, you can that's what I think when I see somebody coming in with a hot take. And I'm like, oh, you just had space to fill. Hot takes are usually bad takes. And anything that you write just because you have a deadline or you need to fill space, mm-hmm, is usually not something you want to stand by. So that's how I think about column writing now. I'm relieved that I don't have the pressure to have a take, even though I don't have a take. And yeah.
That's really interesting. The most popular thing I ever did was like a column. It was called What's Wrong With You.
And where did you do that?
At iFanboy. Like, that was on our website. Like, from from 2008 to 2011, we did it full time. We were producing content, and then I had a kid, and I was like, I can't do this anymore.
Oh,
but you know, anyway, so it was gripey, and people loved it. It was the best thing, you know, in terms of, and it stressed me out so much because
Then you go looking for things to gripe about.
Yeah, well, I don't like doing it, like, because you have to attack something, and then somebody feels bad about that, and I just don't have that in me. Like, I want to talk about, you know, what's great about the comic and how the form works and everything. But I wasn't.
I can remember walking around going, oh, I hope something kind of weird or bad happens around me so that I have something to write about. It was not a good way to go through the world. I don't miss it. I mean, I'm glad I did it, but I don't miss it even a little bit.
So in the middle of Runaways, which I think we've covered. I could go on.
Talk about Runaways. It's
I know you could tell me all about the Doombot.
Very dear to my heart.
You should, and it shows, and it works that
Thanks.
Way. But you did do a graphic novel, Pumpkinheads, with Faith Erin Hicks.
Yep.
Which is a totally different sort of form of comics. You know,
probably it's totally
story wise, a little closer to what you're used to.
A little bit more long form, and a little bit different because Faith is someone who writes her own graphic novels.
Right.
So it was a little bit different working with someone who she writes her own stuff normally. And so she has a way she wants to do it. And we had to connect in a slightly different way.
Yeah. And you don't have anything to sort of work from or you know, the common ground in the same way that with comics.
All new characters.
Yeah. Did you end up approaching it sort of the same way? As you did the comics, or did you approach it more like you would have a novel?
Well, the one major thing is that there's not a set number of pages, so the story can be as long as it needs to be. And the other thing is Faith really wanted to pace it. She wanted to be the person who did the pacing. So instead of being like, on page one, this happens, on page two happens, you know, and you're writing a comic, you're even writing in page turns. You know, like,
mm-hmm.
But for that, it was more purely a screenplay. I didn't break that into pages at all.
Really?
I wrote like a pure screenplay. Now, it was still the language of writing to an artist and not writing to, a film crew or a reader. You know, like, I think we need to see this. And then this person approaches. Mm-hmm. And but Faith very much was the person who then kind of did the thumbnails from that. And that was how she felt most comfortable doing it. And I was so new that I didn't really have strong feeling.
How long had you been working on Runaways at that point? Or was it sort of concurrently?
I can't remember. And I think what might have happened is I started one, and then by the time we were doing the art for Pumpkinheads, Runaways had been in print for a few months. It was all new. It was happening kind of concurrently. Runaways happened first. So my first experience working with an artist and a letterer and all of that was Marvel. But I was I was pretty happy to do it differently with Faith, and I'm pretty happy to do it differently kind of with whoever, really. But yeah, for her, she was just like, it helped her to kind of, in the storytelling, the visual storytelling, to be able to be the person kind of setting the pace.
It's really interesting. I don't think I've heard that, you know, like it makes sense to me, but I don't know if I heard that exact story sort of before something was done, but it makes a lot of sense. It's kind of cool. It's, you know, it's an artist taking a lot more ownership than they maybe need to on a lot of other jobs, but it's kind of cool.
I think there's bigger responsibility. I don't know that I want to say bigger, but a different responsibility for a graphic novel artist, because it's like a year-long commitment. Like, she's drawing it for a year, and she's going to be, you know, it's a year of her life, and then she's sort of accountable for it in a different way. Like, it mm-hmm. belongs to her in a different way. So for Marvel, we're all part-timers. Sure. We're all contractors. So it belongs to Marvel. But Pumpkinheads really belongs to Faith and to me. So I think, and also because, you know, by the time I'm working with Faith, that's like her sixth or seventh graphic novel. She definitely has a way that she feels comfortable working. And she's also very brilliant at pacing. Faith is very good at moments that go on and on and on for four spreads, and you're still in the moment. Like she can really draw out a pause. So she, especially when important things are happening or important motions are happening, she really stretches out and gets very matrixy about it. You know, like when you slow down an important moment. So she really needed to be the person kind of controlling the tempo. I'm going to cough, Josh.
That is... Go ahead.
Okay, go ahead.
That Coke does not wet the whistle.
I'm having a hard time. I'm going to bring me some more water.
If you have to talk for a really long time, the same thing happens to me. So don't sweat it. I'm just having one
problem after that. Hopefully I'm making sense, but...
Yeah, you're totally fine.
Okay.
It's interesting because that, I think, is exactly what I was trying to get at earlier with the comic book storytelling. Because what you're talking about, that's the mechanics of storytelling. That sort of time dilation, I don't know if that's the right word, but, you know, that pacing, which is the thing I love about comics, is that you don't, as a reader, you don't usually notice that happens. But when you do notice how somebody's doing something like that, I find it so impressive. Like, I love that about comics. It doesn't, it's a thing that is, it is unique to comics. You can't do that. At least in such a finite way, in, you know, like in a novel or something like that.
The thing that feels really unique to me is in comics, you have like so many different people all at once doing something. It's more mm-hmm. like a movie in a way than like a novel. In the novel, mm-hmm. it's just you. You know, you're controlling everything.
But did you find that was like difficult to give up that kind of control, or was it freeing?
Every once in a while, it's difficult. You know, every once in a while, you'll hit heads with someone, or you'll... I don't really hit heads usually. Where it's frustrating is when you can't communicate what you see in your head to someone else, or you're really hoping something will kind of go a certain way and you can't quite articulate that, or, you know, you're just having like a breakdown where you're setting something down and they can't quite pick it up and you're like not sure where it's not connecting is frustrating. But the control, no. I mean, I'm still doing novels too, so I still have my projects where I'm in control and I'm doing everything. It's like a comfort to work with other people, and it's a relief, and it brings a different energy into your life to have something you're doing with other people. And if you like and respect them, it's energizing and it's great. It's very rarely like stressful. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't imagine there's a whole lot better than sort of getting pages back of a thing that you kind of thought about and wrote on paper and then. Like, oh,
it's like magic.
Yeah,
no. That was in my head, and then you drew it.
I've experienced. I think probably
when you talk about control, I mean, I am writing the arcs like in 6 months. Mm-hmm. You know, and the thing I'm controlling about is, you know, if I've already written and I need a certain thing to happen in the sixth issue, mm-hmm. then I need all the little pieces of that thing to show up. You know, so mm-hmm. I think the time when I feel like I probably get on the artist's nerves is just when I'm like, no, this has to happen here, because in 5 issues, that's going to change the reality, and I need it to happen here first.
That's just good planning.
But it's probably like, yeah, you know, I'm sure that gets on their nerves.
well, work's not always fun. As you're nearing the end of, how do you get from the end of Runaways to taking over a She-Hulk series and launching a new one of those?
Okay, so I've got like five characters I want to write for Marvel. And whenever Nick asks me to do something, I'm like, no, but I would like to write that character. And he'll say, you can't write that character because they're tied up and whatever, right? They're all tied up all the time. So he knew I wanted to write She-Hulk. He knew I loved She-Hulk. And then there was a Marvel 1000th issue or something. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where all the characters got like one page.
Yep.
He was like, okay, you can write She-Hulk for one page. So Chris, Anka, and Matt Wilson and I did that She-Hulk page. And that was super fun. And then I was like, you know, I want to write She-Hulk. And finally, because of the She-Hulk television show, She-Hulk was given her own book. So she'd been she'd been tied up in the Avengers. So, someone else was writing her. So it wasn't until the TV show was on the horizon that they were like, maybe we'll have a She-Hulk book. And I was like right there to be like, please, 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 let me write it.
Did you have like a thing in mind that you wanted to do?
Yeah, totally. 100%.
Was that the Battle of Hearts?
Yeah. I was like, I didn't get my hot hands on her. I know exactly what I want to do. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Cause I'm just a fan of that character. So
What was the comics that made you fall for that character?
I mean, I think as a kid, I was just drawn. I liked the Hulk, and I was drawn to her because she's cool looking. in my book, Eleanor Park has a crush on She-Hulk. Everybody has a crush on She-Hulk. She's the best. Yeah. I liked that she was funny. You know, she's a female character who has a real personality. Sometimes the female characters in comics, especially in the 80s and when I was reading them, you could only really differentiate them by their hair color. So when a character came in with like a lot of personality, like Jen has, she feels so vivid and so alive. And so I would always just read her when I would just see her. And then I read Dan Slott's She-Hulk and really loved it, and I still love it. I still think the first six issues are like just perfect, I think, and I like the whole run. And I liked Peter David's She-Hulk. So then I read When Charles Soule and
Javier Pulido.
Yeah, Pulido. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then I read Mariko Tamaki's, and so I just always keep up with her. And then along the way, I had read the John Byrne She-Hulk. So I just had read them all, and for me, it's I like them all, but for me, Dan Slott's She-Hulk is just I just could go on and on about it. And I really like Sensational She-Hulk too. So she's this character who has, it's just so much personality, and I just felt like she would be a joy to write.
She's, you pointed out she's had a relatively consistent personality.
Yeah, unusual.
For a long time. Yeah, it's really unusual, and it is unusual for female characters.
And it's unusual for a character who's not she's not like an A-list character. So she's often showing up in other characters' books, and she still has a consistent personality, which is almost unheard of.
Yeah. And she's a fascinating character with a lot of depth. I think it's, there's something about it, like there's a lot of pretty good miniseries about her.
Yeah, I think
you just named a bunch of them. I was thinking when the last one, I was like, Charles Soule was the last one, and he's a lawyer, so that he could sort of do that part of it, but and then the art was amazing. When you started that, I said, oh, I really liked Runaways, and I'll take this, and like right away, it was another fun take on that character. So are you having as much fun with it as it looks like you are?
Oh yeah, I love writing. I love writing Jen. She's a delight. I think the reason there are so many good She-Hulks to read, and the reason that when she shows up, you know, even I'm thinking of A-Force, Kelly Thompson wrote. Ooh. It's just like always good. And I think it's because writers especially love to write her, because she's a consistently funny character. So if you're reading a big team book or a big event, I always feel like Spider-Man gets the best lines. Like if there's a joke, Spider-Man gets it. But then if there are two jokes, She-Hulk gets the second joke. And so I think artists love to draw her. Yeah. Sometimes I think she only gets chosen because they need a splash of green, you know, like they just need some visual interest on the team. So you can tell, I think, that artists and writers and even editors love She-Hulk. So she shows up, and when she shows up, it's like she's always entertaining. So yeah, I love writing her because I think once she's funny, so you can, you know, make her funny or try to make her funny. And she's smart. She's also always been a character with like a real life. It's like from the very beginning, she's had a life outside of being a hero, a life outside of the team. So you get to write her whole life. And then also she's very decent. She's good. So she's kind of a Captain America character where she wants to be a hero. You don't have to talk her into doing the right thing. She wants to do the right thing. She was already doing the right thing as a lawyer before she became a Hulk.
It's interesting too, because she has that self effacing sort of, but which doesn't make any sense because she's 7 feet tall and gorgeous and strong and a lawyer. Like, that should be the most confident person on earth. But yeah, you're right. She's always sort of written more like a real human,
which is exciting. Like, it's exciting that she really likes herself and that her self-effacingness comes sometimes from not wanting to make other people uncomfortable.
Do you think like this about the characters, or is it like you write them that way and then afterward just sort of think about like what you just said to me about that character, like do you go into the character sort of understanding that, or do you write the character and then understand that about them?
No, I go into, I do a lot of research. I like to know the character. So I read every appearance of She-Hulk over a couple months. I'd read like the whole book. I'd like skim sometimes and find the She-Hulk part and read that part. But I really tried to track down every appearance and see. And I took notes. I mean, I like doing this, so that's why I did it. Seriously, no one wanted me to. It's not like Nick. In fact, he probably wishes that I didn't. Yeah. And I like, you know, I have a notebook where I like write down like, okay, in this run, these are the characters who came in. This is what the run was about. This is what her personality was like. This is how the character changed. Okay. In the next run, okay, the new characters. Then that's something she has like a revolving door of supporting characters. She has no consistency over the years. So who came in and how did her personality change? How did her powers change? What did it mean? You know, and you see kind of, as if you do that, you see what sticks and how the character evolved. And really with She-Hulk, John Byrne is the person who came in, and the She-Hulk that we know now is really the John Byrne She-Hulk. Mm-hmm. So you see like just what kind of became more of a part of the canon of the character. And like you were talking earlier that, you know, it's like the illusion of change because it can't all be true. Right? They can't stay 35 and have all these adventures. So it's not real, but you also sort of see like what things about a character feel true to the readers, and what is it about She-Hulk that feels true to us and that we like, and what is it about her that we connect to over time? So yeah, that's the sort of stuff I think about. And then I fill my office with notes. I do these like big post-it notes, and I make lists of like, you know, like what does it mean to be She-Hulk? And for this book, what I wanted was, I wanted it to be like, I feel like, oh God, this is the character I know, even if it's not exactly the character who's, I kind of feel like the classic She-Hulk is a She-Hulk who doesn't exist all in one place, really. It's more the, you know, like the, it's just like a snowball of time and character traits. So, but how can we write a book about, or can we make a book about a character that feels really true to character and very classic?
Was there any way that you approached this newer series from the way that you had approached your first series with Marvel? Like, as you came into this sort of new, like, what did you know that you didn't before that you know, you brought into this project?
So, like, what wisdom or lessons had I learned?
I guess, yeah. And it could even be something technical. It could be something really, you know.
But,
as you go from being sort of a novice at the form, not of storytelling, but of comics, as you know, and you're more wizened now, you know, what's easier about it? What's different about it?
Also, She-Hulk is a totally different vibe because it's a different creative team. I was really lucky on Runaways. I really only worked with two artists on Runaways, Chris Anka and Andres Genele. They did almost, I mean, we had a couple of fill-in artists, but they did the whole 38 issues. I think they split it equally.
And it was consistent. Like they
it was consistent. We even had consistent
other.
Coloring.
No.
Which is really remarkable. And we had Joe Caramagna on letters for the whole run.
Big Joey C.
Yeah.
Love Joe.
he's wonderful.
Yes, he is.
And he's on She-Hulk as well. So it's just the consistency is Nicolo's the editor again. And then Lindsay is Lindsay Kohick. I've never said her name out loud, but is the assistant editor.
That was a real podcast problem in the early days.
Oh, I'm sure.
No one is saying any of those names out loud.
Oh, I'm sure. Lindsay came in at the very end at Runaways, and she's helping Nick out on She-Hulk. But otherwise, you know, it's different team. So we started She-Hulk with Roger Antonio. And then we shifted in the second or the third issue to Luca Maresca. So Luca Maresca is on the book now, consistently, and I think for the near future, for the future that I can see or that any of us can see. And then Rico Renzi is the colorist. And so it's like, you had asked earlier, like, what have I like learned and how is it different? One thing I've learned is that when you're working with an artist, the whole vibe is just going to shift. And even working between Roger and Luca, the vibe shifts because it's just like a different sound, a different smell, a different vibe. Everything is just different. So Luca,
do you feel better able to adjust to that?
I think I feel maybe more that's prepared one of those things you to learn. Adjust yeah. to it. Like I know it's going to happen. And I think my antenna goes out, like trying to pick up what clues I can from this person about what do they want? Like, I just sent an email to Luca today because when I was working with Andres on Runaways, he never wanted to know what was happening. He liked to read the book like a reader would read it. So he did not know any of the big plot stuff that was coming up. He didn't want me to spoil it for him. But I was just thinking, like, oh, Luca might have a totally different feeling about that. You know, maybe he might really want to know, like Chris always wanted to know so that he could steer things. So Luke and I had that conversation today. So yeah, I think I'm a little bit more, my antenna's up a little bit more about like, how is this going to shift? I know it's going to shift from with the, even, you know, even the colorist shifts things. The colorist really controls the mood of the book. So like trying to pick up what I can and learn what I can. I've been lucky that I've had some consistency because you read some books, you know, they have a different person on color every issue or a different person on letters every issue. And that consistency for me as a writer really, really helps me because I get to know the person and I feel like I'm pitching to them better.
Right. I mean, with a character like She-Hulk, that color consistency is the whole game. I mean, that's a character who just pops off a page. And that
we
needs
had a lot
to
of conversation
consistent.
About what color she should be, really, you know, like,
yeah,
because it varies. You know, like, which shade of green is it going to be?
I like that. I like that you had a hand in that, too.
Well, it's
this green is all wrong
had...
for.
Yeah. Oh, I had opinions. It was important to me that her lips are green. Oh, wow. We have mentioned Jen Bartel. That was Jen came on. I think maybe, Jen came on even before Roger. As the cover artist, and that really helped us solidify where we were going with the character once Jen was doing the covers. But that was a conversation we had with Jen because Jen originally did her lips red, and I was like, I really feel like they should be green. but I feel like I thought that I had this whole conversation I was going to have with Jen Bartel about what we were doing with She-Hulk, and instead it was like three texts where she was like, I'm thinking this, and I was like, that's perfect. That's amazing. Do that.
I'm trying to think of what the lips look like on the famous John Byrne cover.
He normally does green. Yeah.
I feel like that's right.
Let's see. The color of She-Hulk in those sensational She-Hulks is I think that's like the gold standard. That green, that dark green hair, the green lips.
They're kind of black or dark, dark green.
Yeah, they're a blackish green. Yeah, for
first
sure.
Sensational
I think it
She-Hulk.
Looks good. She has that lock of hair. All through Sensational She-Hulk that comes right down between her eyes. I love it.
I bought those issues as they were coming out. I was
12. Oh, wow, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I totally remember. That's one of those images that sticks with you. It just, that cover is like one of the all-time covers where she's speaking directly to the camera and it's John Byrne who, you know,
if you
the
were to
artist
go back,
of artists
I think,
at the time.
And look at them now. You would feel that way about more than one cover. You'd be like, when you're looking through the old John Byrne issues, I feel like there's so many covers where you're like, oh, and that's an iconic cover, and that's an iconic cover, and I remember this cover. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just that book stood out and made an impression on me because I'm still talking about it. 1,000 years
Well, and a lot of us, right? And I also think when you, he's got a singular, he's as the artist and the writer and the person doing the covers. I mean, he had, he was able to really do something very focused and singular with that book.
Let me ask you this, and I asked Kelly Thompson this too.
Okay. So is it a girl question? No, just kidding.
Yeah, no, well, kind of. But it, okay. It is in the fact that, you know, women who get hired in comics tend to write female characters, which is a thing. And I wonder, like, are you, is that what you gravitate towards because you want to do that? Or do you ever feel like you get stuck with female characters? I mean, how do you approach it? Because I've asked as any sort of somebody who's not a white male, you know, they give you a character who looks like that, you know?
Right, right.
But you kind of wonder, like, do you want to do the other stuff? Do you feel like you're able? Not able skill-wise, but, you know, would be given it.
Yeah, I for sure feel like I'm able. Yeah,
I'm trying to make that clear.
Yeah.
Do you write men?
Yeah. I mean, I can, but I have to talk in a deep voice the whole time I do it. I think that the answer to that question is there are 5 characters that who are on my list, right? My dream list, and the top 2 are boys.
You're not telling me who those are.
No, because I think it's you jinx it when you tell it. And then
I'm totally fine with that. I understand.
Yeah, because then somebody else is like, well, I would like to write them. And, you know, and then they do. So I think we're at a place where Marvel wants people. They want diverse voices telling these stories. And I think they want more women and non-binary people and people who have, people other than just men telling these stories. And I think I am more likely to get a female character. Like I'm She-Hulk was in my top 5. I wanted her bad. I think I'm more likely to get her because they want women telling Jen's story, and that's not a bad thing, right? I think it's a good thing.
No, it isn't.
Yeah, I think it's
a good
thing.
I just wonder if that makes you feel pigeonholed sometimes though in the opposite way, because it's a good thing, and it's a good thing that there are more diverse voices and not everything is being interpreted through sort of a single lens, but
I will
you're
say
more
that
than just that.
I got offered, I have been offered characters and IP before where I felt you're just offering me that because you need a woman to write it and I have no interest in writing it, so go find some other girl. So for me, I definitely think it helps, right?
Project. Yeah.
But for, it kind of doesn't matter because I connect with, it's like it matters and it doesn't. In this case, I wanted to write Jen. I connect to her partly because she's a woman. And I think she's actually the best female character in Marvel. Like for me, I could make a long case for it, but for me, she's just the best. She's the most, she's got I feel like she's just more alive than most characters, and especially most female characters. She's just vivid and deep in a way that is, some characters you don't come with a lot of depth and they're not as fun to write, but she just is so real. And she's been allowed to have, she's been allowed to have sex and enjoy it, which is very unusual for a female character, and it's just unusual for a Marvel character. Like Jen has been able to have friends. You know, she has friendships. She has a job that matters to her. She has had a very complete and human life, and she's not just a hero, and she's also not just, she's not just a girl. She's not just in a romance comic, and she's not just in a hero comic. She gets to have all kinds of adventures, and I think
she's a grown up.
She's a grown up, and and as a woman, that's what you want for your own life. You want to have all of these rich and diverse and interesting things happening in your life. So, I can tell all kinds of stories with Jen that I maybe couldn't tell with a different character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. I enjoy the book.
Thank you.
That was
terrible.
Funny.
I admire your courage in asking a gendered question. That's hard.
I've tested out on a few people, but it's interesting because this isn't all I want to do, and that must occur to people. But I think that's a good answer. It kind of depends on the spirit in which the project comes from, because I'm sure that other thing happens a lot where it's just we need a girl to write this. We need a right. Native American to write this, whatever.
Oh, so for sure.
Valid. And that must be grating in some ways. But thank you for answering that question.
Yeah, well, you're welcome.
I am going to wrap up. I really appreciate your time. I had a lot of fun talking to you. I hope you had a good time, too.
I did. We didn't talk at all about Jack of Hearts.
I'm such a jerk. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
You need to rest your voice and have some water.
I know. I hope this is usable. Did I sound too? I feel like I finally got it back. I'm sorry. No, I hope it was. Totally, I hope you can scrape something together.
No, you're totally fine. Yeah. No, I've had a terrible day, and this was a great way to end it.
Good,
I always love talking about the art form and the people who know it and are passionate about it. So it's great.
Okay. Well, it's nice to talk to you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And that is another episode of Talksplode in the Books. This happens because of the patrons at ifanboy.com/Patreon. We unlock this show and the book explodes and the media explodes and the hangouts, the whole deal. That's because of listener support. It's the most NPR I've felt in a while. Anyway, you can find out more about Rainbow, again, her actual name, at rainbowrowell.com. And thanks to everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you on the weekly show and all the other stuff that's coming out. Bye. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means, and I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert-extrovert thing, and some people, you know, like, they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away, and, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which, again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people, and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened. But it can be tough to deal with. And also, one of the things is, like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ifanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/ifanboy.